Hey, and welcome to The Living Stone, a podcast from Greystone Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. On this seventh Sunday after Pentecost, Pastor Chrissy's sermon was titled, Reordering Things. Here's Everett with our scripture reading.
Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger of the sons said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me. So he divided the property between them. A few days later, the younger of the son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country. Then he squandered his property in dissolute living. When he spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country. Then he began to be in need, so he went to and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself up with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But he came to himself and said, how many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? I am only dying of hunger. But here I am dying of hunger. I'll get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven. I am before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son, and treat me like one of your hired hands. So he set off and went to his father, but while he was still far away, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to him, to his slaves, quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him, and bring a ring and put it on his finger, and put sandals on his feet, and get the fattest cow and kill it, and let us celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and he is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to celebrate. Now the elder son was in his field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked, what's going on? He replied, your brother has come, and your father has killed a fattest cow because he has gotten him back and safe and sound. Then he became angry and refused to go inside. His father came out and begged and began to plead with him, but he answered to his father, listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you. I have never disobeyed your command, yet you have never given me even a young goat so I might celebrate with my friend. But when this son of yours came back and has wasted your property, you killed the fattest cow for him? Then he came and said to him, son, you are always with me, but all this mine is yours. But when he had to celebrate and rejoice because your brother was dead and has come back to life, he was lost and has been found.
A man had two sons. Or so the story goes. You know the one I'm talking about. A man has two sons, and the younger one asks for his inheritance, and then he squanders it all in just a short amount of time. The older son stays home and lives his life on the straight and narrow, obeying every rule. When the wayward son returns home, everyone, especially the father, seems to have forgotten his sins. The offense of leaving, the poor decisions that he's been making, the absolute and utter irresponsibility all seem to be forgotten. Well, I guess when I say everyone seems to have forgotten, I suppose I should really say everyone except that older brother. See, he's having trouble making room in his heart for this kind of unconditional welcome. He hasn't forgotten a thing. For good reason, this timeless tale is one of the best known stories from our Bible. It speaks to the core of who we are as human beings, trying our best to figure out the ways of the world and the calling of God on our lives to live righteously and faithfully. It speaks to the heart of our experiences in families of origin and in our earliest relationships. Who among us does not relate to one of those brothers? Did we have a little wild streak when we were growing up, a thirst for adventure that may have led us astray for a season of life? Have we made mistakes in our past or messed things up a little bit? Are there things that we remember of which we are deeply ashamed? Or maybe we identify more with that older brother, the one who stayed home. Have we kept all things in our lives under control? Have we done a decent job of following the rules and making wise decisions, working hard and sticking to the plan to make sure that when famine comes, as it often does, that we are prepared for the worst possible scenario? Is that us? Or maybe perhaps time and age and a little good fortune have given us a dose of understanding and solidarity with the loving parent who is forced to mediate between those two polar opposite sons. It's an impossible job to create understanding where there is no real desire to understand. It is thankless work to insist upon grace where there is no capacity for forgiveness, to share in the joy of rebuilding and restoring things to a new order that includes both brothers when calluses have already closed up the hearts of the self-righteous one who stayed home and always colored within the lines, so to speak. You see, there's a little something for everyone here in this story. There's a character with whom we can each identify or perhaps even commiserate. For that reason, countless preachers, theologians, poets, and songwriters and artists alike have examined and interpreted this story, each shedding light on a new piece, offering up a different angle, and creating a new opportunity for transformation. One of the most famous artistic renderings of the parable of the prodigal son hangs in St. Petersburg's Hermitage Museum. It's a beautiful piece by the Dutch painter known as Rembrandt. And while this particular painting was completed near the end of his life, Rembrandt was known to have spent decades wrestling with this particular biblical text, making sketches and drawing different characters and scenes from the story, at times identifying obviously with the younger son, and at other times identifying with the elder. His fascination with the two sons finally led him to creating a masterpiece that his biographers would eventually call the apex of his spiritual homecoming. Defined by the light in the painting, onlookers can see that the three men, father and two sons, they play the most important roles in the story, each one defined by their relationship to the other. Yale theologian Miroslav Volf contends that the familial relationships constitute the very identity of the father and the son. They are each defined by one another. And Volf also asserts that paying attention to those evolving family dynamics, those changing family relationships, is the key to our interpretation and our application of this parable for our lives. In the beginning of the reading from Luke's gospel, Luke introduces us to a man who has two sons, each defined by their right relationship with one another, until the younger son, of course, decides to set out on his own. Well, not only does he leave the family home, but he asks for his inheritance as a way of funding his upcoming adventure. By this request, he severs the relationship that he has with his father, implying that he no longer needs or values the physical and relational shelter that his father is offering to him. Rather, in requesting his inheritance early, he asserts that he would rather go out and live on his own. Some say that in asking for the inheritance early, the younger son was basically telling his father that he wished he was dead. The son chose independence over connection, individuality over family, and in so doing, he dismantled the relational identity of his entire family system. No longer was the man a father of two sons, but a father of one. No longer was the older son a brother to the younger. No longer was the younger son a brother or a son at all. He was just a man alone, trying to find himself out in the world. In a moment of desperation, Luke tells us that the boy who had gone out on his own, he finally awakens to his own loneliness, and he realizes that even his father's workers have it better than he does because they are in relationship with somebody beyond themselves. Having broken the familial tie of sonship, the younger son cannot even imagine the possibility of full reconciliation. So he decides to go home and to ask for something different. He returns home and he begs to be hired on as a worker for his father's land, a second-class citizen for the rest of his life, marked by the sins of his past, none more severe than the severed relationship which changed him from son to worker, from younger brother to hired hand. That certainly must be better than a life lived on one's own. Well, the older son, the one who stayed home, certainly understands everything has changed. He understands that that happened the moment his brother left. He broke the family covenant. He asked to be removed from the system. He left the household, and he broke ties with everybody who loved him. That brother, the one who left, he's as good as dead to the family now, and the older brother will not forget that. We all know. There is absolutely no coming back from the dead. Well, as the story goes, the older brother's heart is hardened after the departure of his brother. Perhaps he's bitter about bearing the full responsibility of the household while his brother is out living large, thinking only of himself. Perhaps he's jealous of all the fun he assumes his brother is having, irresponsibly throwing around family money and chasing after whims, neither working hard nor planning ahead. Or perhaps he is simply grieving the loss of his brother, building up an emotional wall to protect himself from ever having to feel that kind of pain, the pain of death and loss again. Within the framework of the ancient household order, the younger son is indeed gone. He is as good as dead. He's no longer a brother to the one who stayed home. He's no longer a son to the one who handed over all the inheritance. And you can see the pain on the older brother's face, the scorn and the grief as he looks upon his father embracing the son. Dutch priest and popular spiritual author Henry Nouwen writes about his first experience in the Hermitage Museum after a long fascination with Rembrandt's masterpiece. He was excited and anxious, excited to see the painting in person, to observe the strokes from the brush, to gaze upon the fatherly hands as they laid to rest on the back of the son who had finally returned home. He was excited to take in the look of callous rage on the face of the older brother, recognizing that nothing was as he had imagined it would be. At the time of Nouwen's trip to St. Petersburg, he was in a time of deep spiritual discernment. He'd resigned from his professorship at Harvard and was transitioning into a life of intentional community. He'd always felt drawn to the painting, but wondered if seeing it in person would provide some kind of spiritual clarity about his soon-to-be homecoming. He wondered if Rembrandt might be offering him a traveling companion of sorts in his brilliant depiction of those sons. anxious that he might not have enough time to truly sit and see and experience the painting, now and contacted a friend whose name was Alexei. And Alexei promised that he could get him access to the painting away from the casual crowds of tourists who might not be on the same kind of deep spiritual pilgrimage. And so the next Saturday, Nauen arrived at the museum and phoned Alexei from the desk, and Alexei came and met him and took him to the painting that he had traveled so far to see. Amazed by the size of the piece, the vibrancy of the colors and the dance of the sunlight across the canvas, Nauen looked at the painting and he felt like he was home. As tourists came and went, Nauen remained seated on one of the red velvet chairs which was stationed in front of the artwork. He looked on for hours, captivated by the embrace of the father, the revival of the son who was once as good as dead, the son who had broken the bounds of sonship, claiming he would no longer be defined by those family relationships. This was a moment not only of reconciliation. This once dead son was being born again. Well, after several hours with the painting, the guard and the cleaning lady informed Nauen that the museum was closing and it was time for him to pack up his things and to go home. But 4 days later, Nauen returned to the painting. He wasn't quite done yet. And when he returned, he noticed that the early morning sunlight produced a glare on the canvas that made it uncomfortable to look. And so he took one of those red velvet chairs and he moved it a little bit over so that he could once again look at the painting without hurting or straining his eyes. Well, that guard quickly noticed and was very upset that Nauen had moved the chair from its original position, and he ordered him with an outpouring of Russian words and universal gestures to put it back. Well, Nauen tried to explain himself, but the guard was absolutely having none of it. So he put the chair back where it belonged, and then he took himself over and sat down on the floor. Moments later, that guard came over and motioned for him to go and sit on the radiator below the window over there, thinking that it might allow for a decent view. But it wasn't long before a tour guide passed through and insisted that he could not sit on that radiator, but that he must take his place in one of those red velvet chairs. Well, this, of course, infuriated the guard, who marched over to the tour guide and uttered some more Russian words and refocused her attention to that large group of tourists for whom she was responsible. Well, soon after that encounter, Alexei, the friend of a friend, returned to check on Nauen and to see how things were going. The guard immediately approached Alexei and explained everything that had unfolded. And after observing their long conversation from afar, Alexei walked out of the room, leaving Nauen feeling guilty for having caused such a disturbance and wondering if he would ever see Alexei again. After 10 agonizing minutes, which must have seemed like absolutely forever, Alexei reemerged, bringing with him a huge red velvet chair, and placed it on the floor right in front of the painting, beckoning for Nauen to come and take his seat. Nauen, Alexei, and the guard, they all looked at each other, and at the same time, they all smiled. Nauen ended up staying a little while longer, seated comfortably in that red chair pulled from an unknown closet or a room nearby and placed in a prime location just for him. As he left, he passed by that guard, hoping to thank him for putting up with him for so long. And Nauen writes that as he walked and he looked at the Russian guard, he says he looked into his eyes that were hidden under a large Russian cap. And when he did that, he saw a man like himself, afraid, but with a great desire to be forgiven. You know, there's a good bit of irony in the fact that Nauen found himself in his own prodigal son experience, even as he went to gaze upon Rembrandt's masterpiece by the same name. Nauen broke the rules He stepped outside the order that the museum had required, moving a chair, sitting on a floor, sitting on a radiator, and trying to make things work from his own unique experience. But the guard's role, you see, was to uphold that order, to uphold the order of things and to ensure that nobody stepped out of line. His job was to make sure that nobody broke the rules or invited chaos or disruption. Neither one could imagine the new order that Alexei was going to usher in through a simple act of kindness and creativity and understanding and hospitality. Like the father in Luke's parable, Alexei's understanding of the order of things was transformed as he took it upon himself to create a new order when the old order just wasn't working. And in this new order, there was no shortage of red velvet chairs, just as there is no limit to the Father's welcome. There is no final exclusion due to poor choices or bad strokes of luck or even a healthy dose of foolishness. There is only, however, an eternal embrace. An eternal embrace that remembers the relationship that once existed. And in this eternal parental embrace, there is a necessary release because often the old order of things has grown awfully tired. Meaning, the father of that prodigal son in Luke's gospel, he has to let go of the old order. Because in that old order, a son cannot claim his inheritance early and return home as a son. The old order of things would insist that the only way to welcome back a prodigal son would be to reclassify that son as a servant to the family. But allowing the Spirit of God to reorder those old social norms and household relationships opened up a new reality in which there was grace enough for both sons to come and to sit and to dine at the family table. Not because of what they'd done, whether they'd stayed or strayed, but because of who they were, children of the Father. Both children in the parable, like each of us, desperately needed the welcoming and loving embrace of their father. And both children, like each of us, needs to be met with the healing and forgiveness that only Christ can offer when we are willing to reorder our whole lives in such a way that nothing else matters. With this kind of reorientation, we can listen to the pain of our sisters and brothers who are crying out in the streets. We can make room for the dissonance that their stories will have with ours. We can weep with those who are hurting. We can laugh with those who are joyful. And we can rest assured that no matter who we are, no matter where we've come from, and no matter what we've done, there is always one more red velvet chair being pulled out of God knows where and inviting us to sit once again at that expansive family table. Amen.